Well, I want to say good afternoon to everybody and welcome you to the 486th monthly meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Affairs, Foreign Relations. I always get it wrong, don't worry. We decided to make this monthly meeting a special event and to hold it here at the Camden Opera House in recognition of the fact that soft power is a really important part of foreign relations. But we don't spend a whole lot of time, or haven't in the past, spent a whole lot of time publicizing it. So we thought it was good to have a big event like this here in the Camden Opera House, open it to the public, and kind of give people a flavor for soft power, what it is, and what it can accomplish. We're pleased to have three distinguished practitioners of soft power on the stage today. Carla Kronalis, who's until recently was a U.S. diplomat, and she's a practitioner of soft power, and Mohamed Bouabdallah, who is a French diplomat, because after all, soft power is not just the province of the United States. All countries practice some form of soft power. But they're going to be in conversation with moderator Michaela Schweitzer-Blum. Michaela, I'm going to let you introduce our two special guests, but let me say a few words about Michaela. She joined the Maine Monitor after serving for 26 years as a Foreign Service officer. And most of her time in the Foreign Service was done in the Middle East and Southeast Europe. And as a practitioner of public diplomacy, she spent some of her time, although certainly not all of it, both organizing and participating in soft power events. So she's truly an expert in this area as well. You certainly didn't come here to listen to me, so I'm going to turn it over to Mika to make this a smooth running operation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, George, and thank you everyone for coming out on this Sunday afternoon to talk about soft power. I'm very much looking forward to the conversation with Carla and Mohamed. Before we jump into that, let me tell you a little bit more about them and why we've asked them to come and talk about soft power. Mohamed Bouabdallah is a seasoned French diplomat with significant experience in both cultural diplomacy and in multilateral institutions. Prior to coming to the United States, his previous appointments included as cultural counselor of France in Cairo and director of the French Institute in Egypt. He's also served as head of political affairs in the United Nations Directorate in the French Foreign Ministry. He has also worked in the delegation of the European Union in Belgrade and at the European Parliament. He also has local governance experience, having served as a political advisor to the president of Essen, a regional authority in the Paris region. Mohamed is also an academic and has experience as an adjunct professor at Sciences Po in Paris and at the École Nationale d'Administration. As cultural counselor of France and the United States, Mohamed leads France's strategy for cultural, educational, and university exchanges in the United States. So we have a real expert with us in Mohamed. Carla Dirlikov-Kanalis is a world-renowned performer, an academic, an advocate, and an entrepreneur. Carla founded the Kanalis Project, which is a nonprofit arts and advocacy organization, through which she created Hear Her Song, a musical celebration of distinguished female leaders. Carla has served as a U.S. State Department Arts Envoy since 2005, and she was the inaugural senior advisor and envoy for cultural exchange for President Biden's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities. Carla is also a senior fellow at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, and a visiting professor at the Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. Carla was selected by Foreign Policy Magazine as one of its 100 leading global thinkers, the first for an opera singer. Carla has also been a guest speaker at the United Nations, the White House, Oxford University, Aspen Institute, and as a TED speaker. So, Mohammed and Carla, we are delighted that you have chosen to come and join us today to have a conversation about soft power and to be our guests here at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. And we're delighted that you're here in Maine for the first time for both of you. Yeah. So it's not always raining. Carla, I want to start with a question for you, because I think it's important for us to level set the conversation before we really dive in. And as somebody that teaches soft power at two academic institutions in the United States, I wanted to invite you to walk us through the terms that we're going to be using today. Can you help us understand soft power, cultural diplomacy, and cultural exchange?
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Mika. And thank you for being here. This is such a warm welcome on a rainy day, but the warmth is felt and appreciated. I think that defining these terms is firstly difficult, almost impossible, but secondly necessary. It's difficult because we don't really have an international unified definition of culture. What is culture? We could spend the whole time talking about that, but let me try to answer your question fairly quickly. I, like Professor Joe Nye, who we just lost a great academic in him earlier this year, but he of course coined the term soft power. And he defines it as the ability to attract through persuasion rather than through coercion. And so in that context, the soft power of a country has to really do with how attractive is it, not because of an effort that's being put or a coercion or anything hard power related, but rather because of its culture or its ideas. And for a long time, of course, the United States has been viewed as a place of democracy, of freedom, of a very rich popular culture, let's say, whether it's the movies or music. And all of those things have had a very big influence on other countries. I'll come back to that in a moment, but I want to talk about cultural diplomacy and cultural exchange, which are very different. These are actual vehicles for the work. So soft power, which raises or lowers, is the result of culture or influence or ideas. But cultural diplomacy is really an effort to foster mutual understanding, and it's to further the foreign policy objectives, and it's usually led by government. So those are three very important points. Cultural exchange also has the goal of fostering mutual understanding. It does not have the goal necessarily of furthering foreign policy objectives, and it is not necessarily led by government. So I really want to sort of hone in on cultural diplomacy and cultural exchange, because these two terms are often used interchangeably, and I actually think they're quite different. Cultural diplomacy, as we have seen with the Louis Armstrong example, Louis Armstrong was, of course, one of our jazz ambassadors from the Jazz Diplomacy Program that was perhaps the most well-known of the State Department. And that was an effort by the U.S. State Department. These musicians were paid by the United States State Department to further the foreign policy objectives during the Cold War of, you know, reaching places that were perhaps Russia adjacent or USSR adjacent, and sharing American culture. And cultural exchange, on the other hand, is something that even at a time where the State Department may not be doing a lot of programming, this can take place, because cultural exchange can happen not necessarily led by government and not necessarily to further foreign policy objectives. Rather, it's in its simplest form just programming to share, to learn, and to foster mutual understanding between peoples of different ideas. I could go on with cultural awareness and cultural identity, which I think are terms that are also being used quite a bit in this work right now, but I want to keep my time short to answer your question.
Yeah, thank you. And just to quickly follow up, would you, in shorthand, say cultural diplomacy is an official activity, cultural exchange, is more private activity.
I would, Mika, and I would because I think that the distinction is very, very important as we get into the study of this. Mm-hmm. Cultural diplomacy, in my mind, really is government-led, and it has that goal of the foreign policy objectives, mm-hmm. whereas cultural exchange does not. However, both of them can influence the soft power, right? So that's how I see the three of them tied together.
Great, thank you. And Mohammed, would you say this is consistent with how the government of France thinks of cultural diplomacy and soft power? And maybe you could talk a little bit about what aspects of French culture and cultural activities France considers its strongest soft power.
Thank you very much, Michaela, and thank you, George, and the Midcoast Forum, and Cynthia for inviting me to today. I'm very happy to be with you and to engage in this conversation. In France, we didn't coin the term soft power and this, although the first instances of France being involved in activities of cultural diplomacy and therefore building soft power was maybe during the 18th century. Mm-hmm. And quite interestingly, it was after a military defeat, after the signing of the Treaty of Paris, after the War of 7 Years. Mm-hmm. One of our ambassadors, he was a cardinal, he was in Rome at the Holy Seat. And he started to have a kind of cultural activities to attract writers, painters, intellectuals, and therefore trying to compensate the loss of what was perceived as the loss of power of France at this period by having this engagement in cultural activities. Talleyrand, after Napoleon lost, mm-hmm. also, and it's quite famous, during the Vienna Congress in 1815, we were the losing power, and there was this Congress which would reshape the future of Europe. And he was able to, through the parties he would throw, through the cultural parties he would organize, also a gastronomy contest, during which I'm obliged to say that, and you will understand why. So he organized a contest about what would be the best cheese in the world, meaning in Europe. And so every delegation from Europe was asked to bring, 1 week later or 2 weeks later, its best cheese. And so France brought Le Brie. Mm-hmm. And we won. And the funny thing is, I was born in Brie, Contrebert, the capital of Brie in France. So that's why I'm a diplomat today.
A little cultural diplomacy there for your hometown.
Fast forward, after the defeat, we also had victories in our history. Huh? Don't mistake me. But it's interesting to see that impulse by the government, by the state, by the king, or by the republic. After 1870, when we lost to the Germans, there was France felt humiliated, Alsace-Lorraine was lost, etc. And there was this push to create a cultural diplomacy. So there was the Alliance Française that mm-hmm. was created shortly after, and by people like, and it was not government-led, but it was like people very much involved in the public space, like Louis Pasteur, like Jules Verne, like Ferdinand de Lesseps. Mm-hmm. And so now you have 800 Alliance Française all over the world. Mm-hmm. And in the 20th century, during the First World War, to convince the US to be with us, we pushed this agenda through culture, intellectual mm-hmm. debates, etc., etc. And after Second World War, that will be my final point, we obviously it didn't go well for us, even though at the end we were at the table with the winners. We created the position of cultural counselor in the US that I'm holding now. Mm-hmm. And the first one appointed was Claude Lévi-Strauss. Mm-hmm. Because we understood that in the aftermath of the Second World War, it was extremely important to stay close with the US. Mm-hmm. And so we engaged in a cultural diplomacy. So we have been doing that almost for 300 years. Mm-hmm. And I share everything you have said about the definitions. I would just add that what is sometimes overlooked about the definition by Joe Nye is that it's not only about culture, it's about values and policies, and what is most important is the consistency between the three. And you can have the best efforts in culture. If it's not consistent with the policy you are pursuing, then you have a problem. So that would be my contribution to your question.
Well, I'd love to jump forward to today and talk about the work that you're doing now, because I think it's really interesting. The Via Albertine, which you head, is a relatively recent initiative by the government of France, and you now have 10 offices in the United States. And I wonder if you could talk about why the government of France decided to start a Via Albertine, and how it's different than just the traditional cultural diplomacy, and what are you doing?
So we try to innovate and to adjust and to adapt to the world we live in. So over years, we have always tried to find new initiatives to do our work and to reach to people and to the decision makers, the opinion leaders, etc. And we came to a conclusion like 6-7 years ago that there was a risk of indifference between the US and France, like, and Europe. Like the US would, you know, look elsewhere, would look to Asia, would look to other countries. Also a risk of misunderstanding, France being seen as an old country, not being able to tackle its colonial past, etc. So there was all these risks that were identified by us, by my predecessor, by the team. And so we decided to really reinvent our model of doing cultural diplomacy. And so we said, okay, now it should be more about taking time to exchange, to create partnership, and not only just to come to do an exhibition or do a concert or publish a book, but to really to make sure that we spend time with our American friends, American cultural actors, so that we can communicate, debate, and in depth. So that's why we launched this residency program, and it's called Villa Albertine, after Villa Medici in Rome that was created 350 years ago. And the purpose of that is that we believe that the best ambassadors of France are the artists themselves. So every year we welcome 60 French or Francophone artists, so it's also open to artists coming from Africa, North Africa, elsewhere in the world, who has a strong bond with France, and they come to the US, all over the US. It could be in Alaska, it could be in New York, it could be in Maine, everywhere. And so, and they will engage for up to 3 months with the actors in the US. And this creates strong bonds. This creates capacity to debate, to understand each other, etc. So that's what we try to do. Another thing we decided also to do, as you may know, we have 50 French schools in the US. So they are French schools, they are private, but they are following the French program. And a few years ago, we said, we need to expand. We need to do more to promote French learning in the US. And so we created a program called French for All, which today is a big success because we have 200 schools, American schools, mostly public, so it's affordable, it's French for All. So that what we would like to say is that any institution, education institution in the US, wherever, we would like to develop a French program can do it thanks to the support of Villa Albertine and the French Embassy. So you see, we develop new programs over the years to adjust, to adapt to this world, etc. And the new initiative that we launched 3 days ago is a new scholarship for American students to come to France, to go to our best universities. So they will be fully funded. We would like it to be the French Roads scholarship, and we just launched that because we saw that there was a lack of interest by American students to go to France to study. And so we would like to revive this interest through this scholarship.
And what is the scholarship called?
It's called the Lafayette Fellowship, because the first promotion will be in 2026. Mm-hmm. It will be the 250th anniversary of the American independence and of the French-American friendship, because we may have had a responsibility in the independence of this country.
Small role. I think it's a brilliant name choice. I want to ask a quick follow-up on it. How are the artists being received around the United States? You're sending, 60 artists all across the United States. How are they being welcomed?
No, it's a very warm welcome because they take time. I mean, when you are an artist, you have your life, you have your work, you have to do things. And just to take the time of 3 months to go to another country and to stay and to exchange and to reflect and to try to understand, etc. All our American friends are really welcoming and fascinated by this engagement, doing that. And we see more and more cooperation. And now American artists going to France because they are invited by the French artists that were brought to the US. So it's really, there is a strong interest. And also because we do the selection with juries all over the US to select the people, the artists. And those juries, they are composed in majority of American cultural actors, museum directors, theater directors, movie makers, etc. The federal jury is presided by Glenn Lowry, the president of MoMA in New York. Mm-hmm. And so we make sure that the Americans themselves pick the French artists that will come in residency at Villa Alberti.
Yeah, so it's a real partnership.
And you are right to say so, we really want to create a partnership and to make sure that, and we have a post-residency program to finance project between Americans and French following this residency. So we really want to help establish a long-term partnership in the field of culture and education.
Yeah, similar to how we do the Fulbright program, but yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Carla, we don't have the kind of history with cultural diplomacy that France has, but when Farah Pandith was here back in August, she described soft power as underpinning the US foreign policy since 1945. And I wanted to dig into that a little bit with you. Would you agree with that? And how would you describe our cultural diplomacy as having evolved over the last 75 years?
Well, yeah, I think, Farah knows what she's talking about. She's wonderful and a dear friend. But I would say I'm struck by how did this all start for us? And I don't know if you all know the story, but when I think of, when I did my research about how did the US start its cultural diplomacy exchanges, I came across a story which Joe Nye agreed with me was sort of the first instance. And it started with a moose. So I think this is very apropos of being in Maine. There's the story that Jefferson was our first, I believe, ambassador to France. I'm sorry, I didn't come prepared with this off the top of my head, but there was a Frenchman, Comte de Buffon, who had made a lot of remarks about sort of Americans being a little bit degenerate, a little bit, just not as sophisticated. And Jefferson was convinced that he was gonna prove Comte de Buffon wrong. And so when he came over, he insisted on bringing a stuffed giant moose. Few things that are really interesting about this story. Number one, at this time, that was sort of the American culture that was being showcased, was the wilderness, was the beauty of nature. We also, roughly around this time, had Benjamin Franklin wearing those caps with a raccoon hat, I guess that's what they're called. And so this was sort of in vogue at the salons and so forth. Now, it is said that when Comte de Buffon saw this impressive moose on his deathbed, he did take back his comments. He said this was very impressive. So, one could say that American cultural diplomacy, or this, effort to increase the value, started with a moose, and I think that's something you should take pride in, especially here. Of course, during the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, this is where the efforts really started to be much more streamlined and strategic. I would cite Roosevelt's fireside chats as having a lot to do with it, because not only was he finding a way to convey messages to a lot of people, but there's one thing that's consistent that I see with the United States, and that's the use of technology. And back then, radio was, you know, something relatively new and novel in getting this kind of messaging out. Certainly, I agree with Farah that it has been the underpinning. But again, I draw the distinction between what is soft power and what is cultural diplomacy. Soft power, and maybe I can explain it better in this way, has a lot to do with non-government efforts. It can have to do with cultural diplomacy, the jazz ambassadors and so forth. But if you look at Hollywood, for instance, or Levi's jeans, you know, I mean, so many Americana types of things, they have increased the soft power without having anything to do with government. And I think the last point I want to bring up here, Mika, which is an important one, is that unfortunately, unlike my beloved colleagues in France and in most countries, we do not have a Ministry of Culture here. In fact, we are the only country in both the G7 and the G20 who don't have a Ministry of Culture. We're one of very few countries that don't. Our system, and maybe I can just speak about this for one moment, is complicated. I learned it firsthand working in government. We have what's called the four corners: the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Institute of Museum and Library Services, and the President's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities. These are known as the four corners. The NEA, National Endowment for the Arts, of course, funds arts institutions. The NEH funds humanities research and so forth. Institute of Museums and Library Services is the largest funding agency toward libraries and museums. And the President's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities is not a funding agency. Rather, it's a committee which directly offers policy advice to the White House and to the presidents. It's an advisory committee. Those are the four corners. In addition to this, sort of four corners plus, the Educational and Cultural Affairs Bureau, the ECA Bureau at the State Department. And that is the outward facing work that's more international. So some of these four corners do some international work. ECA primarily does most of it. That's where the Fulbright falls under. That's where the work I've done as an arts envoy falls under. Cultural repatriation, preservation falls under that. Now, imagine that, I think it's now 3 years ago, the G20 starts a ministerial track for cultural ministers to have discussions. Who do you send? The chair of the NEA? The assistant secretary of ECA? How is it coordinated? So it's a real problem, and it has been a long-standing problem within our government of who is that ministerial counterpart for the United States. And the last point I'll make is, outside of this whole system I just described, most of our cultural organizations and entities in this country have nothing to do with government. So, you know, Taylor Swift, for example, she's not receiving government funding. So it's a very, very complicated system, and I just want to offer a few sort of outlines for those of you who may not understand it, to better understand the complexities that we're dealing with, not only in how do we fund and how do we curate and how do we think about culture in this country, but how do we engage in cultural diplomacy and cultural exchange work with other countries.
Mohammed, maybe you could pick up on this theme of public-private a little bit and talk about what kind of a collaboration are you working through the Cultural Center, through the Via Albertine. Is there a public-private partnership? Is there a role for the private sector in France in what you're doing here?
I would pick up on what Carla just said. Of course, I'm very much insisted on what we do as a government cultural diplomacy, because that's my job. But of course, we have the same dynamic between soft power, non-governmental cultural exchanges, and cultural diplomacy. But the truth is that in France, because of our story, the nation was built by the state. and not the other way around. Mm-hmm. The state has a very strong role, impact in all dimensions of social life in France, and so including culture. And we have a very old Ministry of Culture. And the cultural diplomacy is not within the Ministry of Culture, by the way. It's within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, mm-hmm. because it's seen as a part, mm-hmm. a strategic part of our diplomacy. Mm-hmm. But they work together hand in hand. And all our cultural sectors in France, if I take cinema, for example, or books, they are public-private partnership. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in France, in order to protect our movie industry after the Second World War, because Hollywood was so powerful, we created a system by which every time you go to the movies, you pay your ticket and the tax is being taken and then put in a kind of bank, a fund called CNC, and that will finance French productions. Mm-hmm. So if you go to see Impossible Mission, you will finance French production. So that's how it works, and that's how France was able to keep its movie industry.
Mm. Interesting.
And so it's private money, but then managed by semi-private, semi-public organization, CNC. Mm. And by the way, the new president of CNC is my predecessor here in the US. And this organization work with us mm. abroad, and especially in the US, to do two things, for example, to do the promotion of French movies for the Oscars. Mm-hmm. So I have the privilege every year to go to the Oscars. And we try to make sure that the promotion of our movies is going well. And in the past 5 years, we had pretty good success. And also, we try to attract productions, American productions, to be done in France. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, in February, May this year, we had a gathering in Versailles, in the Chateau de Versailles, and we had all CEOs of majors, US majors, like Ted Sarandos of Netflix, mm. sitting with the president of France, mm. and I was here as well, and trying to attract those majors to come to France. So it's really private-public partnership. And when it comes to Villa Albertine, we are a public-private partnership because it's half of our resources come from the French government and half is through donations mm. that we gather through our Albertine Foundation. So it's an American non-profit organization which role is to promote cultural exchange between the US and France. Mm. And so we have donations from French companies, US companies, American individuals, French individuals, all people interested in promoting those exchanges and mm-hmm. this friendship. And so it's 50-50 in terms of resources devoted to Villa Albertine. 50 is coming from the French government, and 50 mm. is coming from private donations. Mm.
Mm. That's fascinating. I'm trying to think of I don't think there's any example that mimics that in the US government. Maybe if you can think of one, Carla, but I can't think of anything right at the moment.
Well, I will say right now, things are in flux. You mentioned the Fulbright earlier, and I know that about a month ago, as I understand it, the board of the Fulbright fully resigned, mm-hmm. Unfortunately, because they could not, in good conscience, agree to some of the things that they were being asked to do. So it is a tumultuous time for cultural diplomacy efforts in this country.
I wonder if you could speak a little bit about your experience on the President's Committee for Culture and the Arts, or Arts and the Humanities. Were there instances where you were having conversations about this kind of outreach to private sector, thinking about collaborations between the government, between the cultural community in the United States to try and do some of the things that, for example, France is doing?
Very much so. I mean, again, our system here is just so different. I could say so much more about that, but you know, most arts institutions here rely on private donors. They rely on foundational support that's non-government. In many other countries, the majority of their funding is coming from the government, and then they have to rely a little bit on donors. And those both offer pros and cons, because of course, if you're building a good donor base, then you can get through times where the government maybe is changing and there are different policies and so forth. But of course, you don't have the stability of knowing that you can rely on the government support as you would in other countries. Two things I want to cite. During the Biden administration, it was a very exciting time for cultural diplomacy because Tony Blinken, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, launched the Global Music Diplomacy Initiative. It was a fantastic launch, and I have to say I was there, and he played guitar. He's an amazing musician. He sang and played blues. It was incredible. I think there are videos online. But what was very interesting was that initiative was intended to be a launch of a lot of partnerships, including with the Grammys, and I know that they're moving forward still with that work. So we were trying to take notes a lot from this type of model. My work at the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities was very interesting, and I'll be quite candid with you now that I'm not in government. I wrote a piece, an op-ed, that was critical of the system, which I had described to you, the Four Corners and plus ECA, in light of the ministerial cultural track that the G20 was starting. And I said, how do we do this? We can do better. And I was advocating for some kind of a central office or just a centralized position that could help coordinate all of this. And lo and behold, I got a phone call from the Biden administration saying, okay, well, you know, would you like to come and try to change some things, be the change you want to see? And I was so honored to get to join the administration and to get to do some of that work. What I soon learned was that it is very, very complicated. But I think what all of us learned over the last 4 years during that administration was just how much challenge we are facing here at home in terms of building mutual understanding across different cultures here. And that was eye-opening for me, because most of my life, as the daughter of a Mexican mother, my father is Bulgarian, I'm the firstborn American, I lived in France for a while, I've lived kind of all over, I've spent a lot of my life trying to navigate cultural differences. But then I started to realize, wow, there's a lot of this kind of work that requires deep listening, that requires the exchange of ideas, and that requires, most importantly, time. And we need to learn how to do that here. So I put forth a project called Artist for Understanding, which was intended to build this kind of understanding, specifically toward the national strategy to counter anti-Semitism and the national strategy to counter Islamophobia, among other forms of discrimination that the Biden administration was really looking to address and tackle. And I learned so much leading this work across the country, working in partnership with different cities and mayor's offices and organizations. So I can only say that, yes, to answer your question, we are, I think, at least when I was in government full-time, looking at a lot of partnership models, understanding that that's critical. But maybe I can offer my own insight, which was that I learned that a lot of the principles of the work that I had been doing for the State Department for 20 years, having to do with this understanding, deep listening, and really hoping to forge friendships, which is the word you used. And I think that's the most important goal. Opening the hearts and minds has been talked about a lot, but what about a lasting friendship, and what does that really mean? And that kind of work is needed right now here at home as well.
I want to ask you both, you know, it was interesting that you talked a little bit about the cyclicalness of cultural diplomacy in France and how it came up to the fore whenever France found itself kind of in a challenging position. And I think we've seen some of that in the United States as well. For example, at the end of the Cold War, mm-hmm. there was an argument, we don't need soft power anymore. Right. We won the Cold War, we're good. And I think you hear, particularly now, an argument that the world is so interconnected, that there's such a global culture, if you will, that this is not necessary. Soft power is global. So countries don't need to engage in cultural diplomacy or cultural exchange is an argument that you often hear. And I think sometimes why it's challenging to get movement, particularly in the US government. And I wonder if you could each comment on that. I'm happy to have maybe Carla, Mohammed, do you want to, or Carla, whoever would like to speak first, but what comment on that. How do you balance the global culture that we have now with a country's soft power, unique influence, and is that needed?
Now, surely there is a more global connection. We know more about what's going on elsewhere in the world. There is more exchanges, but still, because more and more foreign policy is connected to the domestic agenda, which is quite new. I mean, Kissinger once said one of the biggest threats is when foreign policy is connected to domestic agenda, domestic policy, and today that's the case. I mean, you see many foreign policy decisions taken because of what the people think or what the political institutions think that the people think. So therefore, it's important to have this kind of trying to convince and to connect to the people all over the world. So it's needed. It's more than ever needed. That's the first thing. Second thing is, I wouldn't rely my foreign policy objectives on social media. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important that we have this effort to act and to give a voice or to support artists, educators, and also people-to-people connections, real connections. I'm being told, why do you want to bring American students to France with the Lafayette Fellowship? Today we have AI, so you don't need to learn French. We have Zoom, so you don't need to travel, etc., etc. But we believe, it's a belief, that nothing replaces a one-to-one conversation, a presence, etc. So that's what we think. So that's why we think we need to do that again. So, and at the end of the day, what we witness is that other countries are investing in their soft power, in their cultural diplomacy, in cultural exchanges. So if other countries are doing that, there is a reason. And for sure, we have been doing that in France for many, many, many years. And we will continue to do that.
Carla, do you want to comment on the question?
Yeah, I do. I have 3 points I'd like to make. The first is I want to just raise the example of Hallyu, or the Korean wave, that's happened in the last few years. So interestingly, I think they are the best example that I can think of soft power in the last 20 years, and it's something I had the chance to discuss with Joe and I as well. For those of you who may or may not know, South Korea has really had this boom in culture, you know, as an export. Their music, the K-pop is very, very popular. Films, I mean, the film Parasite won an Oscar just a few years ago. The TV show Squid Games on Netflix was like the number one show. Food, K-beauty, it's really a big thing. And of course, this was largely supported by their Ministry of Culture initially. And it's very interesting because for a country that wanted to distinguish itself as being different from Japan, different from China, different from North Korea, you know, and in Asia, they really thought of their culture and they leaned into that. And obviously we're seeing a huge recognition for that. Their tourism numbers are up. The amount of young people that have registered to learn Korean is skyrocketed. I remember looking at some of the statistics and numbers were like a 200% boom. Again, I didn't prepare it for today, but very, very big, dramatic increase. And that's a very good example of a country that has leaned into that. Secondly, do we need to think about it here in the United States? I think the obvious answer is yes. We're going to need to really think about not just soft power, but what are the efforts that we as Americans need to take to build back that mutual understanding that is at the core of this work? What are the efforts we can take now? What are the efforts we will need to take in the future? So that's, I think, a short answer to that. But the third point I want to raise is There are efforts that we can take through cultural exchange, and then there are the government-led efforts through cultural diplomacy. But this gets a bit tricky, and the best way to put it is through the Martha Graham example. So Martha Graham, very well-known dancer, had been a U.S. arts envoy for many years. She did a lot of touring on behalf of the State Department. And she very famously said to the press, "I am not a propagandist. I'm not here as propaganda," right? And so I want to lean into that, because when the government is channeling a cultural effort, it may seem that the government is trying to control a messaging, or that this is somehow coercion of some sort. But when the artist stands up and says, "No, I'm not a propagandist. I'm here because I'm not afraid to speak against my country," right? "I'm not afraid to say what I want to say," then that actually ends up being sort of this reversal of how we look at things. And I think it's very interesting, because we started the conversation with, of course, Louis Armstrong. When he was out as a cultural ambassador, it was a very difficult time in this country, a lot of racial strife. And, you know, many people have cited the challenges of that for Dizzy Gillespie, for Louis Armstrong, who canceled several of the tours because he did not feel that the government that was inviting him was doing the right thing by his community. And so you can imagine the complexities to that. But at the end of the day, our country, and I can say this myself having served state for 20 years, we don't tell artists what to say. Right? I've never received a briefing in all of the work that I've done about I have to go out and promote America or make America seem great. It's really about going out and sharing my story. I'm a firstborn American. My parents are immigrants. Do I like certain things about my country? Of course. I'm very proud of my country. Are there things that I think we could do better? Yes. And I can speak about that. So I think that that's the point I want to make here, is that that's very important and not always the case, and we need to hold on to that.
Now, I would like to react on what you just said, because that's extremely important. Because it doesn't work if it becomes propaganda. So
exactly.
So I really agree with you, and our constant policy has been to not to interfere into the cultural work of the artists that we are supporting. It's extremely important, so because otherwise it doesn't work, doesn't align with the values we promote as being a country with a democracy, free speech, freedom of creativity, etc. So that's extremely important, and by the way, the artists wouldn't agree, and so we would be in a difficult situation. And sometimes it, when you are a diplomat and you have someone standing in your cultural center criticizing your government, well, it happens. And then you say, well, that's the beauty of what we do. Sometimes it's even trickier when there is a criticism of the host country. And here we have to be sensitive, to be careful, because of the Vienna Convention, we are not supposed to intervene in the domestic affairs of the country we work in. So there we have to do some, not, it's not censorship, it's just to be careful and to find a way to say things. But all over the world, French Institute, Villa Albertine, we are spaces where people can speak. And I served in Yugoslavia, I served in Egypt, I served in Belgium, and in all these places, we would have a space where artists, thinkers could speak freely. Yeah. And then the people that would attend those events, they would say, there is a value in France, because I can attend this kind of conversation, and we can be free and exchange. And that's extremely important. And second thing about South Korea, which is very funny, is that the French government has invested a lot in helping South Korea designing its Ministry of Culture and its different agencies, etc. And they have been doing it beautifully, and now maybe even better than us. And so I just recruited to Villa Albertine someone who came from South Korea. She was working in the Korean agency for creation, and so now she will be heading my cinema movie department. So hopefully we'll regain some...
Very smart. Yeah. I wonder if we could bring it down to a really granular level, because I want I want to make sure that the audience has a sense for when we're talking about these events, what is actually happening? What is the spark? You know, when we talk about Louis Armstrong going overseas and playing jazz, how is that an influence? How does that change things? And you've been in that position. You've been overseas. You've been the arts culture, the cultural envoy. Talk us through an instance that you remember that really stuck with you, where you went to a foreign place to represent the United States, mm-hmm. U.S. culture. What happened?
Yeah.
And can you talk through, just try and bring that to life for us.
Yeah, oh gosh, yeah. I mean, I've had the chance to do this work for 20 years. I don't even know how many countries. But my first mission was the one that really got me hooked. So I was asked to go to Mexico. I hold both citizenships, so this was like a kind of a homecoming in a way. But here's the thing. Oftentimes, we as performing artists, and my background is I'm an opera singer, we're sort of, you know, expected to park and bark. That's what we call it. You park yourself on the stage, you bark, and then you think, well, that's cultural diplomacy. I got hired by the government. I'm here. I'm doing that. And I'm going to ask, like, is that really, what did we exchange if we do that? Like, I've maybe shared some of my favorite songs with you. Hopefully some of them were American songs, you know, but like, what did I learn from you? And what do I take back home and share with my friends, or what do you take back home? And so that's the challenge with the model, is how do you find ways to truly exchange your thoughts, your beliefs, your culture? This first mission I did in Mexico went down to a place called Campeche. This was in 2005. I was right out of grad school, which I went to in Montreal, at McGill. I'm very proud to be closer to back up there. And they didn't know what to do. They were planning, you know, concerts and having diplomats attend the concerts. And I was sort of scratching my head, like, what's going to come of this? And while the diplomats were in the room trying to sort out the details, I sort of was outside and I saw these kids and they were playing football, but you know, they didn't have shoes on. Like, they were just, it was just a rough little game of football. Now, Campeche is a city where there's no McDonald's, even back then. There was, I mean, this was sort of a very untouched area, mostly Mayan culture. Mayan is still a language that is spoken there. And that's why the American embassy wanted to go in there and have these conversations with folks, because there were a lot of people leaving those communities to immigrate. Meanwhile, I'm playing with the kids, and I said, you know, I speak fluent Spanish, and can I join your game? And we start playing football, and at the end, or football, soccer, I said, well, you know, thank you for letting me join your game. Can I sing a song for you? And they said, yes. And so I start singing, and they said, well, can we sing a song for you? Of course. And so then, you know, we started singing, and then when the diplomats came out, I said, look, I've got an idea. Let's do a concert together with these kids. Let's just figure it out. It doesn't have to be formal repertoire. You know, we'll do a little workshop. So long story short, I formed a choir with the kids. We did the concert. Their parents came. All of these people who would not normally come into the concert hall came. A year later, these kids opened for Andrea Bocelli's concert in Campeche. And about a year and 6 months later, they won the Coming Up Taller Award at the White House under George W. Bush. So these kids went to the White House. Can you imagine for these young kids to go to something like that, the message that sent to them? And can you imagine from a diplomatic standpoint also what that message was sending? The kids formed a choir. The funds from that award went to begin a community center. That community center is still standing today. They still do exchanges with Americans today. Many of those kids I'm still in touch with. They've gone on to go to college. I didn't know that many of them were orphans. And so the relationships that have been fostered there now for 20 years, that's a beautiful example to me of cultural exchange. And I want to just say one more thing, if I may. You know, you asked to get down to a granular level. I've never worn boots on an opera stage. You know, I usually have to wear like heels or costumes or gowns. But I think, you know, I know that when I leave Maine, people will comment and go, oh my gosh, your boots are so cool. Where did you get them? And I'll say, I got them in Maine. Oh, what's it like in Maine? Well, I have to tell you, I was in Camden. It's so charming and so beautiful. And, you know, the people are really wonderful. And I got to do this talk. And all of a sudden, this small thing will open a dialogue with all kinds of people. I'll probably take my boots to China when I go next month, tell them about Maine. And so cultural exchange can happen through these very small, granular conversations. And it's something that the beauty of it is any of us can participate in that. We don't have to wait for a government-led program. You can just get a pair of very, very cool boots and share them with all your friends.
It's a very exciting time, I think. Exciting to talk to both of you, and thank you very much. And thank you to everybody for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.